This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
All the non-cowards of Santa Fe are here who brave the cold weather. Thank you so much for making it tonight. My name is Jeremy Scahill, and I'm going to be your host tonight for this exciting evening where we are launching Tom Engelhardt's new book, The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. I'd like to start off by just giving a very deep, heartfelt thank you to the Lannan Foundation for making this event and so many others possible. On a personal note, I also want to say that the reporting that I'm able to do and my colleagues at Democracy Now! And The Nation magazine are able to do would be very difficult if we did not have the support of Patrick Lannan and the Lannan Foundation. Including support, I recently was in Afghanistan reporting for The Nation and for Democracy Now! On U.S. targeted killings and the killing of innocent civilians, and we are very grateful to the Lannan Foundation to support that work. As I'm sure many of you have been following very closely the developments in Egypt, the situation is rapidly deteriorating there. As we saw today, pro-Mubarak gangs of thugs have been out in the streets beating people, beating pro-democracy demonstrators. And despite the fact that the body count is rising, that the bloodshed is increasing, the Obama administration refuses to issue a direct call demanding that Hosni Mubarak step down and that the Egyptian people's will be respected. We have seen a week go by here where the U.S. State Department, headed by Hillary Clinton, said a week ago that the Mubarak regime was stable. Then we heard the Vice President Joe Biden say that Hosni Mubarak is not a dictator. And then this morning, P.J. Crowley at the State Department, he must have a Ph.D. in cluelessness, said it's unclear to us who's instigating the violence in Cairo. Well, one of the reasons we know who's instigating the violence in Cairo is because of the incredibly brave reporting from unembedded journalists from Al Jazeera and Democracy Now! And other networks that are independent. My dear friend Sharif Abdel Quddus, whose family is from Egypt and who grew up in Egypt, has been reporting there on the airwaves of Democracy Now! And over the internet on Twitter. And people kept writing to us and asking, how is Sharif able to tweet if they shut the internet down? Well, we worked a system to break down the Egyptian firewall so that we could get Sharif's tweets out and the reporting out to the world. And I'd be happy to talk about that with folks later. But tonight we're here for a wide-ranging discussion with an incredibly brilliant man, Tom Engelhardt. Now, I've known Tom for a number of years, and he is one of the most meticulous, careful, and insightful editors you could ever meet. In fact, he's still editing my piece on the initial invasion of Iraq from 2003. It should be published anytime soon. He was going to read from his book today, but Julian Assange has leaked it on WikiLeaks, so you can just get on your Blackberries and iPhones now and read it. You know, so many, many people in journalism and authors, fantastic authors, people like Noam Chomsky, know Tom Engelhardt as this incredible editor. Tom edited books by Chalmers Johnson, the great, great freedom fighter that we unfortunately lost recently. He's edited books also by another freedom fighter that's a friend of this community, Howard Zinn. Alfred McCoy, an incredibly brilliant man from the University of Wisconsin who has done amazing work to expose the history of U.S. torture programs. His work also edited by Tom Engelhardt. But Tom is also well known on the web because he's the editor of one of the most valuable newsletters that exists anywhere in the world, and that is Tom Dispatch, where Tom literally takes people that sometimes the world has never heard of and turns them into primary players in analyzing the world that we live in. People like Ann Jones, an incredibly brave woman who spent so much time in Afghanistan and helping to push back against the myth and lie laboratory that resides in Washington and is pushing false narratives about the war in Afghanistan. Tom gave prominence to a young historian named Nick Turse, who's one of the most brilliant young historians we have, exposing war crimes from the Vietnam War to the present. Tom's new book is a tour de force. Tom has done something that few could do with dignity and grace, and that is to weave some of his personal history into a damning expose about the U.S. war machine. We are so deeply honored to be here tonight with all of you and to share this exciting launch of Tom Englehart's new book, The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. Please join me in giving a warm welcome on this cold night to Tom Englehart.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. After a 24-hour odyssey from New York, I'm relieved to be here in northern Minnesota. And thanks to Jeremy for that. A man, by the way, who single-handedly began the process that left Eric Prince of Blackwater in flight for Abu Dhabi. There's really no way to thank Patrick Lannan and Lannan Foundation for their support of Tom Dispatch over these years and for having me here. I mean, except to say the obvious, which is thank you, heartfelt. And the same for Anthony Arnov of Haymarket Books. He's my editor as well as publisher, and as someone who has spent close to 40 years as a professional editor, I know a good one when I run across one. It's probably no mistake, by the way, that I became an editor and have remained so these last 40 years. I prefer being behind the scenes. It comes naturally to me. It's where I feel most comfortable accessing my brain, not, I assure you, out here in front of all of you. Nonetheless, here I am, and I'm going to read you three pieces tonight, all evidence of a late-in-life adventure I stumbled into, which is my website, tomdispatch.com. Pieces at the site generally reflect my particular obsessions, especially with the militarization of our society and our seemingly perpetual wars in distant lands. Tonight, you'll meet a few of those obsessions. The first piece I'm going to read is the introduction to my new book, The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. It's called, Is America Hooked on War? War is Peace was one of the memorable slogans on the facade of the Ministry of Truth, or Minitrue, in Newspeak, the language invented by George Orwell in 1948 for his dystopian novel 1984. Some 60 years later, a quarter century after Orwell's imagined future bit the dust, the phrase is, in a number of ways, eerily applicable to the United States. On September 10, 2009, for instance, a New York Times front page story by Eric Schmidt and David E. Sanger was headlined, Obama is Facing Doubts in Party on Afghanistan, Troop Buildup at Issue. It offered a modern version of journalistic newspeak. Doubts, of course, imply dissent. And in fact, just the week before, there had been a major break in Washington's ranks, though not among the Democrats. The conservative columnist George Will wrote a piece offering blunt advice to the Obama administration, summed up in its headline, Time to Get Out of Afghanistan. In our age of political and audience fragmentation and polarization, think of this as the Afghan version of Vietnam's Walter Cronkite moment. The Times report on those Democratic doubts, on the other hand, represented a more typical Washington moment. The focus of the piece was a planned speech by Michigan Senator Carl Levin, chairman of the Armed Services Committee. He was, Schmidt and Sanger reported, hoping to push back against well-placed leaks in the Times, among other places, indicating that War Commander General Stanley McChrystal was urging the president to commit 15,000 to 45,000 more American troops to the Afghan war. Here, according to the two reporters, was the gist of Levin's position about what everyone agreed was a deteriorating U.S. position. Quote, he was against sending more American combat troops to Afghanistan until the United States speeded up the training and equipping of more Afghan security forces. Think of this as the line in the sand within the Democratic Party. Both positions could be summed up with the same word, more. The essence of this debate came down to more of them versus more of us. And keep in mind that more of them, an expanded training program for the Afghan National Army, actually meant more of us in the form of extra trainers and advisors. In other words, however contentious the disputes in Washington, however dismally the public viewed the war, however much the president's war coalition might threaten to crack open, the only choices were between more and more. In such a situation, no alternatives are likely to get a real hearing. Few alternative policy proposals even exist because alternatives that don't fit with more have ceased to be part of Washington's war culture. No serious thought, effort, or investment goes into them. Clearly referring to Will's column, one of the unnamed senior officials who swarmed through our major newspapers made the administration's position clear, saying sardonically, according to the Washington Post, quote, I don't anticipate that the briefing books for the administration principals on these debates over the next weeks and months will be filled with submissions from opinion columnists. I do anticipate they will be filled with vigorous discussion of how successful we've been to date. State of war. Because the United States does not look like a militarized country, it's hard for Americans to grasp that Washington is a war capital, that the United States is a war state, that it garrisons much of the planet, and that the norm for us is to be at war somewhere, usually, in fact, many places, at any moment. Similarly, we've become used to the idea that when various forms of force or threats of force don't work, our response, as in Afghanistan, is to recalibrate and apply some alternate version of the same under a new or rebranded name, the hot one now being counterinsurgency or COIN, in a marginally different manner. When it comes to war, as well as preparations for war, more is now generally the order of the day. This wasn't always the case. The early republic that the most hawkish conservatives loved to cite was a land whose leaders looked with suspicion on the very idea of a standing army. They would have viewed our hundreds of global garrisons, our vast network of spies, agents, special forces teams, surveillance operatives, interrogators, rent-a-guns, and mercenary corporations, as well as our staggering Pentagon budget and the constant future wargaming and planning that accompanies it, with genuine horror. The question is, what kind of country do we actually live in when the so-called U.S. intelligence community lists 17 intelligence services ranging from Air Force Intelligence, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Defense Intelligence Agency to the National Reconnaissance Office and the National Security Agency? What could intelligence mean once spread over 17 sizable, bureaucratic, often competing outfits with a cumulative 2009 budget estimated at more than $55 billion, a startling percentage of which is controlled by the Pentagon? What exactly is so intelligent about all that? And why does no one think it even mildly strange or in any way out of the ordinary? What does it mean when the most military-obsessed administration in our history, and I'm obviously referring to George W. Bush's, which year after year submitted ever more bloated Pentagon budgets to Congress, is succeeded by one headed by a president who ran, at least partially, on an anti-war platform and who then submitted an even larger Pentagon budget? What does this tell us? What does this tell you about Washington and about the visibility, the viability of non-militarized alternatives to the path George W. Bush took? What does it mean when the new administration, surveying nearly 8 years and 2 wars worth of disasters, decides to expand the U.S. armed forces rather than shrink the U.S. global mission? What kind of a world do we inhabit when, at a time of mass unemployment, the American taxpayer is financing the building of a 3-story, exceedingly permanent-looking, $17 million troop barracks at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan? This, in turn, is part of a taxpayer-funded $220 million upgrade of the base that includes water treatment plants, headquarter buildings, fuel farms, and power-generating plants. What kind of world are we living in when a plan to withdraw most U.S. troops from Iraq involves the removal of more than 1.5 million pieces of equipment? Or in which the possibility of withdrawal leads the Pentagon to issue nearly billion-dollar contracts, new ones, to increase the number of private security contractors in that country? What do you make of a world in which the U.S. military has robot assassins in the skies over its war zones 24/7, and the pilots who control them from thousands of miles away are ready on a moment's notice to launch missiles, hellfire missiles at that, into Pashtun peasant villages in the wild mountainous borderlands of Pakistan and Afghanistan? What does it mean when American pilots can be at war in Afghanistan 9 to 5, by remote control while their bodies remain at a base outside Las Vegas, and then they can head home past a sign that warns them to drive carefully because this is the most dangerous part of your day? What does it mean for our security and future safety, the Pentagon funds the wildest ideas imaginable for developing high-tech weapons systems, many of which sound as if they came straight out of the pages of sci-fi novels? Take, for example, the next generation bomber, an advanced platform, that's what they call it, slated for 2018, or a truly futuristic bomber, quote, a suborbital semi-spacecraft able to move at hypersonic speed along the edge of the atmosphere for 2035. What does it mean about our world when those people in our government peering deepest into a blue skies future are planning ways to send armed platforms up into those skies and kill more than a quarter of a century from now? And do you ever wonder about this? If such weaponry is being endlessly developed for our safety and security, and that of our children and grandchildren, why is it that one of our most successful businesses involves the sale of the same weaponry to other countries? Few Americans are comfortable thinking about this, which may explain why global arms trade pieces don't tend to make it onto the front pages of our newspapers. In September 2009, The Times Pentagon correspondent Tom Shanker, for instance, wrote a rare piece on the subject. But it appeared inside the paper on a very quiet Labor Day. Despite slump, U.S. role as top arms supplier grows, was the headline. Perhaps Shanker, too, felt uncomfortable with this subject because he included the following generic description. Quote, in the highly competitive global arms market, nations vie for both profit and political influence through weapon sales, in particular to developing nations. The figures he cited from a congressional study of that highly competitive market told a different story. In sales to developing nations, for instance, the United States inked $29.6 billion in weapons agreements, or 70.1% of the market. Russia was a vanishingly distant second at $3.3 billion, or 7.8% of the market. In other words, the United States actually has what, in any other field, would qualify as a monopoly position. In this case, in things that go boom in the night. It seems that this, along with Hollywood films that go boom in the night, is what we now do best, as befits a war, if not warrior, state. Is that an American accomplishment you're comfortable with? Consider this. War is now the American way, even if peace is what most Americans experience while their proxies fight in distant lands. Any serious alternative to war, which means our security, is increasingly inconceivable. In Orwellian terms, then, war is indeed peace in the United States, and peace is war. American newspeak. Newspeak, as Orwell imagined it, was an ever more constricted form of English that would, sooner or later, make all other modes of thought impossible. It was intended, he wrote in an appendix to his novel, that when newspeak had been adopted once and for all, and old speak forgotten, a heretical thought should be literally unthinkable. When it comes to war and peace, we live in a world of American newspeak in which alternatives to a state of war are not only ever more unacceptable, but ever harder to imagine. If war is now our permanent situation, it has also been sundered from a set of words that once accompanied it. It lacks, for instance, victory. After all, when was the last time the United States actually won a war? Unless you include our victories over small countries incapable of defending themselves, like the tiny Caribbean island of Grenada in 1983 or powerless Panama in 1989. The smashing victory over Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War only led to a stop-and-start conflict now almost two decades old that has proved a catastrophe. Keep heading backward through Vietnam and Korea, and the U.S. military was last truly victorious in 1945. But achieving victory no longer seems to matter. War American style is now conceptually unending as our preparations for it. When George W. Bush proclaimed a global war on terror, aka, as the neoconservatives like to say, World War IV, conceived as a generational struggle like the Cold War, he caught a certain American reality. In a sense, the ongoing war system can't absorb victory. Any such endpoint might indeed prove to be a kind of defeat. No longer has war anything to do with the taking of territory either, or even with direct conquest. War is increasingly a state of being, not a process with a beginning and end and an actual geography. Similarly drained of its traditional meaning has been the word security. Though it has moved from a state of being, secure, to an eternal, immensely profitable process whose endpoint is unachievable. If we ever decided we were either secure enough or more willing to live without the unreachable idea of total security, the American way of war and the national security state would lose much of their meaning. In other words, in our world, security is insecurity. As for peace, war's companion and theoretical opposite, it too has been emptied of meaning and all but discredited. Appropriately enough, diplomacy, the part of government that classically would have been associated with peace, or at least with the pursuit of the goals of war by other means, has been dwarfed by, subordinated to, or even subsumed by the Pentagon. In recent years, the U.S. military, with its vast funds, has taken over or encroached upon a range of activities that once would have been left to an underfunded State Department, especially humanitarian aid, operations, foreign aid, and what's now called, ominously, nation building. Diplomacy itself has been militarized and, like our country, is now hidden behind massive fortifications. The State Department's embassies are now bunkers and military-style headquarters for the prosecution of war policies. Its officials, when enough of them can be found, are now sent out into the provinces and war zones to do civilian things. And peace itself? Simply put, there's no money in it. Of the nearly $1 trillion the United States invests in war and war-related activities, nothing goes to peace. No money, no effort, no thought. The very idea that there might be peaceful alternatives to endless war is so discredited that it's left to utopians, bleeding hearts, and feathered doves. As in Orwell's Newspeak, while peace remains with us, it's largely been shorn of its possibilities. No longer the opposite of war, it's just a rhetorical flourish embedded, like one of our reporters, in war speak. What a world might be like in which we began not just to withdraw our troops from one war to fight another, but to seriously scale down the American global mission, close those hundreds of bases. As of 2010, there were almost 400 of them, macro to micro, in Afghanistan alone, and bring our military home is beyond imagining. To discuss such obviously absurd possibilities makes you an apostate to America's true religion and addiction, which is force. However much it might seem that most of us are peaceably watching our TV sets or computer screens or iPhones, we Americans are also always marching as to war. We may not all partake. We may not all bother to attend the church of our new religion, but we all tithe. We all partake. In this sense, we live peaceably in a state of war. By the way, when it comes to that $55 billion budget for the U.S. intelligence community I mentioned, that I cited when I wrote this piece back in late 2009, we now know, thanks to a major Washington Post series called Top Secret America, that it's actually $80 billion, and that number in turn is probably an underestimate, and the almost $1 trillion we spend on national security and military, Pentagon, so on and so forth, that I mentioned in the piece. I'll have a piece at Tom Dispatch, not mine personally, but another writers, probably in the next few weeks. And again, we'll find out that that figure is, in fact, much higher. Both are just a small measure of the continual growth of our war state and our state of war. Now, the next piece is an older one and, in a way, more personal. It reflects an early obsession, one that my generation was perhaps the first in history to experience because we were the first to face the idea of end times, not as a religious possibility, but as cold practical reality, thanks to what was known as our victory weapon in World War II. I'm talking about nuclear weapons, of course. This piece I wrote originally for a newspaper just as the last century was ending, and then updated and posted at Tom Dispatch on the 59th anniversary of the dropping of the first atomic bomb at Hiroshima in 2004. I called it Three Characters, No Dialogue. Even though we promptly dubbed the site of the 9/11 attacks in New York City Ground Zero, once a term reserved for an atomic blast, Americans have never really come to grips either with the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki or the nuclear age they ushered in. There can be no question that, as the big bang that might end it all, the atomic bomb haunted Cold War America. And when the Cold War finally ended with the Soviet Union's quite peaceful collapse, a nuclear peace dividend never quite arrived. The arsenals of the former superpower adversaries remain quietly in place, drawn down but strangely untouched, awaiting a new mission, while just beyond sight, the knowledge of the making of such weapons spread to other countries, ready to launch their own threatening mini-Cold Wars. In 1995, 50 years after that first bomb went off above Hiroshima, it still proved impossible in the U.S. to agree upon a nuclear creation tale. Was August 6, 1945, the heroic ending to a global war or the horrific beginning of a new age? The Enola Gay, the iconic plane that dropped the Hiroshima bomb, and an iconic shattered school child's lunchbox from the Peace Museum in Hiroshima could not yet, it turned out, inhabit the same exhibit space at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Today, such once uniquely world-threatening weapons have had to join a jostling queue of world-ending possibilities in the dreams of our planet's young. Still, for people of a certain age like me, Hiroshima is where it all began. So I would like to try, once again, to lay out the pieces of a nuclear story that none of us, it seems, can yet quite tell. In my story, there are three characters and no dialogue. There was my father, who volunteered for the Army Air Corps at age 35, immediately after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. He fought in Burma, was painfully silent on his wartime experiences, and died on Pearl Harbor Day in 1983. Then there's me, growing up in a world in which my father's war was glorified everywhere, in which my play fantasies in any park included mowing down Japanese soldiers. But my dreams were of nuclear destruction. Finally, there is a Japanese boy whose name and fate are unknown to me. This is a story of multiple silences. The first of those, the silence of my father, was once no barrier to the stories I told myself. If anything, his silence enhanced them, since in the 1950s, male silence seemed a heroic attribute. And perhaps it was, though hardly in the way I imagined at the time. Sitting in the dark with him, then, at any World War II movie, was enough for me. As it turned out, though, the only part of his war I possessed was its final act. And around this, too, there grew up a puzzling silence. The very idea of nuclear destruction seemed not to touch him. Like other school children, I went through nuclear attack drills with sirens howling outside, while, I had no doubt, he continued to work unfazed in his office. It was I who watched the irradiated ants and nuclearized monsters of our teen screen life stomp the earth. It was I who went to the French film Hiroshima Mon Amour, where I was shocked by my first sight of the human casualties of the A-bomb. On the beach to catch a glimpse of how the world might actually end. It was I who saw the mushroom cloud rise in my dreams, felt its heat sear my arm before I awoke. Of all this, I said not a word to him, nor he to me. On his erstwhile enemies, however, my father was not silent. He hated the Japanese with a war-bred passion. They had, he told me, done things that could not be discussed to boys he had known. Subsequent history, the amicable American occupation of Japan or the emergence of that defeated land as an ally, did not seem to touch him. His hatred of all things Japanese was not a ruling passion in my childhood, only because Japan was so absent from our lives. There was nothing Japanese in our house. One did not buy their products. We avoided the only Japanese restaurant in our part of town, and no Japanese ever came to visit. Even the evil Japanese I saw in war movies, who might sneeringly hiss, "I was educated in your University of Southern California," before they met their suicidal fates, were, I know now, regularly played by non-Japanese actors. In the end, I followed my own path to Hiroshima, drawn perhaps to the world my father so vehemently rejected. In 1979, as an editor, I published Unforgettable Fire, the drawings of Hiroshima residents who had lived through that day. It was, I suspect, the first time any sizable number of images of the human damage there made it into mainstream American culture. I visited Japan in 1982, thanks to the book's Japanese editor who took me to Hiroshima, an experience I found myself unable to talk about on return. This, too, became part of the silences my father and I shared. To make a story thus far would seem relatively simple. Two generations, each across a chasm of a war and an act that divided them. It is a story we all know. And yet, there is my third character and third silence, the Japanese boy who drifted back into my consciousness after an absence of almost four decades only a few years ago. I no longer remember. I can't even imagine how he and I were put in contact sometime in the mid-1950s. Like me, my Japanese pen pal must have been 11 or 12 years old. If we exchanged photos, I have no memory of his face, nor does a name come to mind. If I can remember half-jokingly writing my own address at that age, 40 East 58th Street, New York City, New York, USA, planet Earth, the solar system, the galaxy, the universe, I can't remember writing his. I already knew by then that a place called Albany was the capital of New York State, but New York City still seemed to me the center of the world. In many ways, I wasn't wrong. Even if he lived in Tokyo, my Japanese pen pal could have had no such illusions. Like me, he had undoubtedly been born during World War II. Perhaps in his first year of life, he had been evacuated from one of Japan's charred cities. For him, that disastrous war would not have been a memory. If he had gone to the movies with his father in the 1960s, he might have seen Godzilla not the U.S. Air Force, dismantle Tokyo. And he might have hardly remembered those economically difficult first years of American occupation. But he could not, at that time, have imagined himself at the center of the universe. I have a faint memory of the feel of his letters, a crinkly thinness undoubtedly meant to save infinitesimal amounts of weight and so money. We wrote, of course, in English, for much of the planet, if not the solar system, galaxy, universe, was beginning to operate in that universal language which seemed to radiate from my home city to the world like the rays of the sun. But what I remember most are the exotic-looking stamps that arrived on or in his letters, for I was, with my father, an avid stamp collector. On Sunday afternoons, my father and I prepared and mounted our stamps, consulted our Scott's catalog, and pasted them in. In this way, the Japanese section of our album was filled with that boy's offerings, without comment, but also without protest from my father. We exchanged letters, none of which remain, for a year or two or three, and then, who knows what interest of mine or his overcame us, perhaps only the resistance boys can have to writing letters. In any case, he too entered a realm of silence. Only now, remembering those quiet moments of closeness when my father and I worked on our albums, do I note that he existed briefly and without discussion in our lives. He existed for both of us, perhaps, in the ambiguous space that silence can create. And now I wonder sometimes what kinds of nuclear dreams my father may have had. For all of us, in a sense, the Earth was knocked off its axis on August 6, 1945. In that one moment, my father's war ended and my war, the Cold War, began. But in my terms, it seems so much messier than that. For we, and that boy, continued to live in the same world together for a long time, accepting and embroidering each other's silences. The bomb still runs like a fissure, but also like an attracting current, a secret unity through our lives. The rent it tore in history was deep, and the generational divide, given the experiences of those growing up on either side of it, profound. But any story would also have to hold the ways, even deeper and harder to fathom, in which we lived through it all together in pain, hatred, love, and most of all, silence. In this 59th year after Hiroshima, a year charged with no special significance, perhaps we will think a little about the stories we can't tell, and about the subterranean stream of emotional horror that unites us that won't go away whether, as in 1995, we try to exhibit the Enola Gay as a glorious icon or bury it deep in the earth with a stake through its metallic heart. For my particular story, the one I've never been able to tell, there is a Japanese boy who should not have been but briefly was with us, who perhaps lives today with his own memories of very different silences. When I think of him now, when I realize that he, my father, and I still can't inhabit the same story except in silence, a strange kind of emotion rushes up in me, which is hard to explain. Thank you. One more. Finally, my third piece of the evening. I wrote it just as this year began, and it will be part of my next book from Haymarket to be called The United States of Fear. It's my attempt to explain just why, and we're having an example of it, you know, this week as we sit here right outside in Washington, just why Washington seems so remarkably brain dead in its foreign and war policies, why in a world changing startlingly quickly, and not just in the Middle East, there seems not a new idea under the sun in Washington. I've called it the urge to surge Washington's 30-year high. Just as 2010 ended, the American military's urge to surge resurfaced in a significant way. It seems that leaders in the Obama administration and senior military commanders, those are both in quotes, that's what they were called in this newspaper article I'm citing, because so many times people have things to say in our newspapers from Washington and we don't know who they are. In any case, senior military American military commanders in Afghanistan were acting as a veritable WikiLeaks machine. They slipped information to New York Times reporters Mark Mazzetti and Dexter Filkins about secret planning to increase pressure in the Pakistani tribal borderlands, as well as on the Pakistani government and military via cross-border raids by U.S. Special Operations Forces in the new year. In their front-page story, you could practically slice with a dull knife American military frustration over a war going terribly wrong, over an enemy, shades of Vietnam, with sanctuaries for rest, recuperation, and rearming just over an ill-marked, half-existent border. You could practically taste the chagrin of the military that their war against, well, you name it, terrorists, guerrillas, former Islamic fundamentalist allies, Afghani and Pakistani nationalists, and God knows who else, wasn't proceeding exactly swimmingly. You could practically reach out and be seared by their anger at the Pakistanis for continuing to take American bucks by the billions while playing their own game rather than an American one in the region. If you were of a certain age, you could practically feel, shades of Vietnam again, that eerily hopeful sense that the next step in spreading the war, the next escalation, could be the decisive one. Admittedly, these days, no one talks, as they did in Vietnam and in the Iraq years, about turning corners or reaching tipping points, but you can practically hear those phrases anyway, or at least the mingled hope and desperation that always lurks behind them. Take this sentence, for instance. Quote, even with the risks, military commanders say that using American Special Operations troops could bring an intelligence windfall if militants were captured, brought back across the border into Afghanistan, and interrogated. End quote. Can't you catch the familiar conviction that when things are going badly, the answer is never less, always more, that just another decisive step or two, and you'll be around that fateful corner? In this single New York Times piece, you can sense just how addictive war is for the war planners. Once you begin down the path of invasion and occupation, turning back is as difficult as an addict going cold turkey. With all the sober talk about year-end reviews in Afghanistan, about planning and progress, it's easy to forget that war is a drug. When you're high on it, your decisions undoubtedly look as rational, even practical, as the public language you tend to use to describe them. But don't believe it for a second. Once you shot up this drug, your thinking is impaired. Through its dream haze, unpleasant history becomes bunk. What others couldn't do, you fantasize that you can. Forget the fact that crossing similar borders to get similar information and wipe out similar sanctuaries in Cambodia and Laos in the Vietnam War years led to catastrophe for American planners and the peoples of the region. Forget the fact that no matter whom American raiders might capture, they have no hope of capturing the feeling of nationalism, or its tribal equivalent, that, in the face of foreign invaders or a foreign occupation, keeps the underarmed resilient against the mightiest of forces. Think of the American urge to surge as a manifestation of the war drug's effect in the world. In what the Bush administration used to call the Greater Middle East, Washington is now in its third and grimmest surge iteration. The first took place in the 1980s during the Reagan administration's anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan and proved the highest of highs. The second got rolling as the last century was ending and culminated in the first years of the 21st century amid what can only be described as delusions of grandeur or even imperial megalomania. The third started in 2006 in Iraq and is still playing itself out in Afghanistan as 2011 commences. 3 decades after the American urge to surge in Afghanistan helped destabilize one imperial power, the Soviet Union, the present plans, whatever they may turn out to be, could belatedly destabilize the other superpower of the Cold War era. And what our preeminent group of surgers welcomed as an unprecedented strategic opportunity, that was their phrase, and we'll get to them in a couple of minutes, as this century dawned, may, in its later stages, be seen as an unprecedented act of strategic desperation. That, of course, is what drugs, taken over decades, do to you. They give you delusions of grandeur and then leave you out on the street, strung out and without much to call your own. Perhaps it's fitting that Afghanistan, the country we helped turn into the planet's leading narco-state, has given us a 30-year high from hell. Getting high in Afghanistan. As 2011 begins, what could be eerier than reading Soviet documents from the USSR's Afghan debacle of the 1980s? It gives you chills to run across Communist Party General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev at a Politburo meeting in November 1986, almost 7 years after Soviet troops first flooded into Afghanistan, insisting to his colleagues that the Afghan war must be ended in a year, at maximum 2. Yet with the gut-wrenching sureness history offers, you can't help but know that even 2 years later, even with a strong desire to leave, which is yet to surface among the Washington elite, a decade into our own Afghan adventure, imperial pride and fear of loss of credibility would keep the Soviets fighting on to 1989. Or what about Marshal Sergei Akhromiev, offering the same Politburo meeting an assessment that any honest American military commander might offer a quarter century later about our own Afghan adventure? Quote, "There is no single piece of land in this country that has not been occupied by a Soviet soldier. Nevertheless, the majority of the territory remains in the hands of the rebels." Or finally, the pathetic letter the Soviet military command delivered to the head of the UN mission in Afghanistan on February 14, 1989, arguing, just as the American military high command would do of our war effort, that it was not only unfair, but even absurd to draw parallels between the Soviet-Afghan disaster and the American war in Vietnam. That was, of course, the day the last of 100,000 Soviet soldiers, just about the number of American soldiers there today, left Afghan soil, heading home to a sclerotic country bled dry by war, its infrastructure aging, its economy crumbling. In November of that same year, the Berlin Wall would be torn down, and not long after, the Soviet Union would disappear from the face of the earth. Reading those documents, you can almost imagine CIA Director William Webster and his euphoric Afghan team toasting the success of the agency's 10-year effort, its largest paramilitary operation since the Vietnam War. The Reagan administration's surge in Pakistan and Afghanistan had been profligate, involving billions of dollars in a massive propaganda campaign, as well as alliances with the Saudis and a Pakistani dictator and his intelligence service to fund and arm the most extreme of the anti-Soviet jihadists of that moment. Freedom fighters, as they were then commonly called in Washington. It's easy to imagine the triumphalist mood of celebration in Washington among those who had intended to give the Soviet Union a full blast of the Vietnam effect. They had used the war part of the Cold War to purposely bleed the less powerful, less wealthy of the two superpowers dry. As President Reagan would write later in his memoirs, quote, "The great dynamic of capitalism has given us a powerful weapon in our battle against communism, money. The Russians could never win the arms race. We could outspend them forever." By 1990, the urge to surge seemed a success beyond imagining. Forget that it had left more than 1 million Afghans dead and more dying, that one-third of that impoverished country's population had been turned into refugees, or that the most extreme of jihadists, including a group that called itself Al-Qaeda, had been brought together, funded, and empowered through the Afghan war. More important, the urge to surge in the region was now in the American bloodstream. And who could ever imagine that, in a new century, our freedom fighters would become our sworn enemies? Or that the Afghans, that backward people in a poor land, could ever be the sort of impediment to American power that they had been to the Soviets? The Cold War was over. The surge had it. We were supreme. And what better high could there be than that? Fever dreams of military might. Of course, with the Soviet Union gone, there was no military on the planet that could come close to challenging the American one. Nor was there a nascent rival great power on the horizon. Still, a question remained. After centuries of great power rivalry, what did it mean to have a sole superpower on planet Earth? And what path should that triumphant power head down? It took a few years for this question to be settled, but settled it was definitively on September 12, 2001. And for all the unknown paths that might have been taken in this unique situation, the one chosen was surprisingly familiar. It was the very one that had helped lead the Soviet Union to implosion, the investment of national treasure in military power above all else. However, to those high on the urge to surge and now eager to surge globally, the fate of the Soviet Union seemed no more relevant to an American future than what the Afghans had done to the Red Army. Previously, the arms race, like any race, obviously, had involved at least two and sometimes more great powers. Now it seemed there would be something new under the sun. An arms race of one, as the U.S. prepared itself for utter dominance as a military presence unique in the annals of history. Thanks to the destructive acts of 19 jihadis, the urge to surge would, with finality, overwhelm all other urges in the fall of 2001, and there would be a group ready for just such a moment for, as the newspaper headlines screamed, a Pearl Harbor of the 21st century. To take full stock of that group, however, you would have to return to June 3, 1997, the day a confident crew of Washington think tank, academic, and political types calling themselves the Project for a New American Century, or PNAC, posted a fin de siècle statement of principles demanding that the Clinton administration, or assumedly some future one with a better sense of American priorities, quote, increase defense spending significantly. The 23 men and two women who signed the initial PNAC statement urging the United States to go for the military option in the 21st century would, however, prove something more than your typical crew of think tank types. After all, not so many years later, after a disputed presidential election settled by the Supreme Court, Dick Cheney would be vice president, I. Lewis Scooter Libby would be his right-hand man, Donald Rumsfeld would be Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense, Zalmay Khalilzad, the first post-invasion U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, and that's just to start down the list of PNAC signers. This may, in fact, be the first example in history of a think tank coming to power and actually putting its blue sky suggestions into operation as government policy. Or perhaps it's the only example of a government in waiting masquerading as an online think tank. In either case, more than 13 years later, the success of that group can still take your breath away, as can both the narrowness and scope of their thinking in their seminal document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, published in September 2000, 2 months before George W. Bush took the presidency. The ambitions of this crew of surgers extraordinaire were caught by James Peck in his upcoming book, Ideal Illusions, this way, quote, in the Reagan era, Washington organized half the planet. In the Bush era, it sought to organize the whole. Rebuilding America's Defenses remains a remarkable document. In many ways, canny about the direction war would take in the near future, it was a clarion call to ensure this country's unchallenged supremacy into the distant future by military means alone. In 1983, in an address to the National Association of Evangelicals, President Ronald Reagan famously called the Soviet Union an evil empire. It wanted, as he saw it, what all dark empires and every evildoer in any James Bond film desires, unchallenged domination over the planet. And it pursued that domination in the name of a glorious world revolution. Now, in the name of American safety and the glories of global democracy, we were, so the PNAC people both pleaded and demanded, to do what only evil empires did and achieve global domination beyond compare. We could, they insisted, enforce an American peace, a Pax Americana, for decades to come. If only we poured untold billions, they refused to estimate what the real price might be, into war preparations and, if necessary, war itself, from manifold new forward operating bases on land to the seven seas, space, and cyberspace. Pushing, quote, the American security perimeter, end quote, ever farther into the distant reaches of the planet was, they claimed, the only way that U.S. military supremacy could be translated into American geopolitical preeminence. The only way that the homeland, yes, unlike 99.99% of Americans before 9/11, they were already using that term, could be effectively defended on a planet then without obvious enemies. They couldn't have thought more globally. They were, after all, visionaries, as druggies tend to be, and on military matters, they couldn't have been more up to date. Yet on the most crucial issues, they couldn't have been dumber or more misguided. They were fundamentalists when it came to the use of force and idolaters on the subject of the U.S. military, which they believed capable of doing just about anything. As a result, they made a massive miscalculation, mistaking military destructiveness for global power. Nor were they capable of imagining that the greatest military power on the planet might be stopped in its tracks by a ragtag crew of Iraqis and Afghans. To read Rebuilding America's Defenses today is to see the rabbit hole down which, as if in a fever dream, we would soon disappear. It was a genuine American tragedy that they came to power and proceeded to put their military-first policies in place. That, on December 12th of the year that changed everything. The PNAC people seized the reins of defense and foreign policy, mobilized for war, began channeling American treasure into the military solution they had long desired, and surged. That urge to surge was infamously caught in notes on Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's comments taken on September 11, 2001. "Go massive," the notes quote him as saying. "Sweep it all up, things related and not." And so they did. They swept up everything and then watched as their dreams and geopolitical calculations were swept into the dustbin of history, and yet the urge to surge, twisted and ever more desperate, did not abate. The Soviet path. To one degree or another, we have been on the Soviet path for years, and yet, ever more desperately, we continue to plan more surges. Our military, like the Soviet one, has not lost a battle and has occupied whatever ground it chose to take. Yet, in the process, it has won less than nothing at all. Our country, still far more wealthy than the Soviet Union ever was, seems now to be entering its Soviet phase. The U.S. economy looks increasingly sclerotic. Monies for an aging and rotting infrastructure are long gone. State and city governments are laying off teachers, police, even firefighters. Americans are unemployed in near record numbers. And yet, taxpayer money continues to pour into the military and into our foreign wars, into what can only be described as part of America's war stimulus package abroad. And of course, the talk for 2011 is how to expand the American ground war in Pakistan. History and common sense assure us that this can only lead to further disaster. Clear-eyed leaders, military or civilian, would never consider such plans. But Washington's 30-year high in the region, that urge to surge still coursing through its veins, says otherwise, and it's not likely to be denied. Sooner than later, Washington, the Pentagon, and the U.S. military will have to enter rehab. They desperately need a 12-step program for recovery. Until then, the delusions and the madness that go with surge addiction are not likely to end. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Wow. I'm seldom at a loss for words, but I was just sitting there with Patrick, and both of us are just kind of shaking our head in amazement. I mean, it's incredibly powerful, Tom, what you've done.
Thank you.
It's really, I mean, it's in this era of Twitter and iPhones and SMS texting, just to sit for, you know, 45 minutes or so and listen to the work of someone who clearly has spent a lifetime thinking about these issues and struggling with them is, it really puts to shame a lot of the people masquerading as journalists and historians these days. You know, Tom, you were talking about the think tankers, and I always think, you know, now when I look at those people, I always think of what my good friend Naomi Klein says, that they're people paid to think by the makers of tanks.
Yes, and in this case, literally, think tankers now are hired by the, I mean, David Petraeus, General David Petraeus, our Afghan war commander and as CENTCOM commander, he hires these guys. They go out, they do studies for him, they take tours, they get all this special stuff, and then they come back and go into the think tanks and the media goes to them, and then they just talk as objective people talking about the very situation they've been working for the U.S. military.
In fact, people call Petraeus Cheney's general, which is really incredible Obama has really taken a number of the most sort of vile characters from the Bush administration and actually continues to rely on them to one extent or another. I mean, you know, Secretary of Defense Gates was basically a gunrunner during the Soviet war in Afghanistan, a major league spook.
And by the way, he wrote a classic memo about the Soviet Union as it was going down saying it wouldn't fall.
Right. Trust us, we're experts.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was recently interviewing an Army colonel who was forced into retirement early on during the Iraq invasion under the Bush administration because he didn't go along with the sort of neocon version of events and his war planning suggestions, which were much more closely in line with General Jay Garner, who wanted a much swifter in and out for the United States and to actually work with the Iraqi military rather than to disband it, thus creating 250,000 enemies. But he also went to West Point with General Petraeus, and he told me that General Petraeus has been bragging around town how much money he's going to make when he leaves the military and goes into the private sector. You know, and it's not even a revolving door. It's like a bridge. People just walk back and forth between mercenary companies, government, mercenary companies.
And we know from one of your favorite generals, Stanley McChrystal, who was who headed
We're
up
thick as thieves,
yeah,
me and Stan.
Who headed up the hunter killer teams in Iraq. When he finally got axed by the president, he's now out on the lecture circuit, getting $35,000 to $60,000 for giving lectures on leadership.
Right, exactly. And of course, is at Yale. And there's something I think that sort of is just painfully and bloody perfect about the fact that he's ended up in an Ivy League school. Yeah. You know, this guy who ran the targeted killing operations, not just in Afghanistan, but he was the head of the Joint Special Operations Command from 03 to 08, before assuming the command, where they essentially declared war on the world, this whole neocon notion of the world as a battlefield.
Yeah, well, Cy Hirsch said that he ran basically an executive assassination crew out of Cheney's office, is what he actually said,
right.
as I remember it.
They circumvented the chain of command. Yeah. Tom, the first bigger picture issue that I wanted to get into with you is this. Early on, when Obama was running for the presidency, both you and I did a lot of work critical of the Obama administration's foreign policy team, of the vision that they were laying out, and it really seemed as though there was a disconnect between what they were putting out in terms of policy papers and then the rhetoric. There was this broad perception on the left in particular that Obama somehow was an anti-war candidate. And yet the positions that they were staking out, the advisors that they were taking, were the really hawkish, belligerent wing of the Democratic Party. So much so that I felt it necessary when I started reporting on the Obama administration to put in my bio at the end that I pledged to be the same journalist under Obama as I was under Bush. Because oftentimes, true courage or principle is defined when people you actually like are in power and are doing all these vicious things around the world, not the people that you dislike, like President Bush. But as we see this sort of war in Afghanistan that you were talking about get worse and worse by the day, more and more bloody, more people dying, the Iraq war not going away anytime soon despite the rhetoric, the drone bombings continuing, the preventative detention, Guantanamo still open, how much of a substantive change, if any, have you seen? Because you're one of the experts, particularly on that last part of the Bush administration. Yeah. How much of a substantive change have we actually seen in U.S. foreign policy from Bush to Obama?
No, I would say, I mean, there were two Bush administrations, would be at least part of the answer. The first Bush administration, those early years, the Bush people, I mean, they were visionaries. Now, they were mad visionaries, and they were wrong about all sorts of things, but they had a vision of the world, geopolitically, how it worked. They wouldn't have explained it to you or to me, but they had it. The flow, they had a vision of the flow of energy. They were old cold warriors, and they had a vision of rolling back what was left of Russia. They had an idea of how they were going to take and run the world. As I said in that piece, they miscalculated terribly, but you could call them visionaries. After they failed, after it was a disaster, the final couple of years of the Bush administration were kind of a managing the disaster. And it's in those couple of years that Robert Gates, who really is a kind of a, I mean, he's a perfectly smart guy. He's an apparatchik. He's been there forever. He was brought in. He's an old H.W. Bush guy. And it's that Bush that has carried over into the Obama years. So that if you look, and I have to say, like you, I think 10 days after the election, when Obama won, I wrote a piece that I headlined, Don't Let Barack Obama Break Your Heart. And it was my warning, because I could see that while he was bringing in some good new thinkers in various areas, and the two areas that were going to matter most and have mattered most, which were economic, which I know less about, and foreign policy, military, he was bringing in the same old stale air, and you could only expect so that the people he brought in for his new administration, he brought in Gates, who was just the carryover defense secretary, he brought in as his national security advisor an ex-Marine General Jones, who was a friend of McCain's, and of course for his secretary of state, he brought in somebody who, if McCain had actually won the election in a close election, McCain might have reached out to for secretary of state. So you and those people, not surprisingly, as a crew, you know, continued the Bush years. So that Obama has surged endlessly, just to take Afghanistan. But the first surge, the first set of troops going in, were going in under under Bush. That is, Obama arrived and American troops started going in, but that was the Bush surge. And then he simply continued that surge in 2009 with two other huge surges and all the other surges that went with them, the CIA, the State Department, all the mercenaries you write about, the money, and so on and so forth. So basically, this was ditto in Iraq. And then I'll stop. In Iraq, it was the Bush people who worked out the agreement by which we are now withdrawing most of our troops.
The status of forces agreement.
He's they're carrying out the Bush policies. And, of course, they're using that to try and strengthen the war that he wanted to fight from the election, which is the Afghan-Pakistan war.
Right. And just so people understand, I mean, what we're seeing in Iraq right now, there's a lot of talk about how Obama's ending the war in Iraq, but the embassy that the United States has constructed there, which cost almost $1 billion as it was, this massive colonial fortress, is the size of 80 football fields.
Yeah.
It's the size of Vatican City. You know, the Vatican has embassies around the world. We have an embassy the size of the Vatican in Iraq, which necessitates thousands of mercenaries. And Hillary Clinton, late last year, actually asked for a radical expansion of the number of private security contractors in Iraq to fill the void being left by some of the combat troops being pulled out. But Tom, one of the lines that you hear when you talk critically about actual policy, not cult of personality, not partisan politics, when you talk about policy, people say, well, come on, I mean, you can't be so hard on Obama because he inherited this big mess from Bush. What do you say to that?
I say that anything that takes us down the path of more, I mean, the inability, I actually believe, I consider Obama in foreign policy terms a great sadness, because I believe that in fact, it would have been possible. It would have been horrible. We know the echo chamber of the right, the media echo chamber of the right. We know the screams that would have gone up if he had said, I'm getting those troops out of Iraq, and I'm getting those troops out of Afghanistan. And I knew that he would never do this. I wrote a speech that's in this book, In the American Way of War.
You wrote a speech for Obama?
For Obama, just before he gave his speech, in which he actually escalated in Afghanistan in 2009. I wrote a speech suggesting, you know, a speech in which he would say, we're ending, not extending, two wars. And I think a Democratic president, with all the dangers, could have done that. There would have been a lot of shouting, but it would not have turned out to be an unpopular thing. The wars would, in fact, have ended. I think he had an opportunity to do that. He had been swept into office. But it's inconceivable in the Washington of this moment. I mean, you have to imagine that Washington is such a tight and narrow place. The thinking in it is so tight, so narrow, and so stale that you can't even think about something like that. So a Democrat coming in is only worried, if I get out of those wars, I'm going to be blamed. I mean, we're getting to this right now, if you want to turn for a second to the present. Amazing what's going on in the Middle East right now. The issue at home lurking there, nobody's writing it yet, but the Obama administration, I can guarantee you, is completely obsessed with it already, is if Egypt really goes down, it's not the army in the end taking over, not another pro-American administration, if it really goes down, et cetera, and other things happen, the debate in the United States is going to be a very familiar one, and they know it, and they're scared of it already, who lost the Middle East? Mm-hmm. I know they're already thinking about this.
Right. I mean, I do a lot of talking to people and with people in the Middle East and around the region, and have been in constant around-the-clock contact with a number of people in Egypt, but also in other Arab countries. The Jordanians are very nervous, where there's a monarchy there that's been very ruthless, and the Mukhabarat, the secret police, are very feared and very despised. You have Ali Abdullah Saleh in Yemen, and of course, we hear a lot now about al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and the Obama administration is waging a covert war inside of Yemen. The Yemen's president today saying he's not going to stand in another election and he won't pass power to his son. I mean, there's a lot of nervousness in that region. So you have that dynamic. But then on the flip side, I've noticed that the goodwill that Obama seemed to have won by giving some of his very public speeches in Cairo and elsewhere in the Arab world is almost vanishing overnight because of what is perceived to be total inaction on Egypt and supporting this thuggish regime of Hosni Mubarak, and this guy Omar Suleiman that Mubarak named as his vice president, ran the U.S. torture program in Egypt. He ran the extraordinary rendition program. And so, but people, you know, I grew up in a Catholic household and going to Catholic schools. They talk about sins of omission, And I think that, you know, the Arab world is saying right now, why is Obama committing these sins of omission by not doing anything to help us? I mean, what do you think about that dynamic in terms of the perception that Obama was changing things versus now first major crisis he's dealing with?
Well, I mean, I think I'd have to tell you what I think is actually happening right now. I mean, I'm no expert on the Middle East, so although I would mention two other countries you didn't mention, because lurking again behind the scenes, one is Saudi Arabia. There, I guarantee you there's a lot of nervousness about Saudi Arabia. This would be the big, I mean, of the pillar, the so-called American pillars. Saudi Arabia and the Saudi Arabian stock market took a nosedive the second this started. And, of course, the other one is Pakistan, which theoretically isn't the Middle East, but the Bush administration created this kind of fantasy construct called the Greater Middle East. And then with their global war on terror, they kind of swept it into a kind of reality. Some of this moment is happening now because the Bush people basically, in a way, created both this entity, the Greater Middle East, and then drove a stake through its heart. Mm. They drove destruction right through its heart. And that combination, I mean, I think what you're actually seeing right now is when we think about the Cold War, we think about the Cold War ending in 1991, because that's when the Soviet Union went down, and that's because we think we won the Cold War. I've always believed, I'm not original in this, there were declinists before me, but I've always believed that there were two losers to the Cold War, that one was much more powerful than the other, and it's headed very slowly over these years towards the exits, waving in a total state of self-congratulation, and that's us. And we've hustled ourselves towards this exit in two ways, because we had two waves of unilateralism, the second of which we all think of as unilateralism here in this room. That's what George Bush did. They went out, they thought they could do it with the military, they turned Iraq into a carcass. I mean, it was an extraordinary act, and it was before Obama ever got there. But the first wave of unilateralism, which we don't think of in the same way, was the Clinton unilateralists, and they were economic. They wanted to turn, like the Greater Middle East, they wanted to turn the world, the globe, into one globalized place. They wanted to discipline it with the IMF so that you had profitable types of poverty. And they wanted to take, and their unilateralism came to fruition in 2008 when the world economy melted down at the same time that the Bush unilateralism reached its end. You know, and in essence, that now, and I believe that as the Soviet Union went down in a wave of people power in Eastern Europe, in its near abroad, we're not going to go down the same way. We're much more powerful. But our far abroad, you might say, our imperial structure is beginning to really shudder. And it's going to get worse because in the country you know most, I mean, not the only one, but the country you know so much about, Pakistan, we are going to make things, we are going to destabilize Pakistan far worse in the next couple of years. And that's the most frightening country on earth as far as I'm concerned in terms of that. So,
right. I wanted to, because we have limited time here, I wanted to make sure to ask you, I wanted to ask you a couple of personal questions. But as you were reading your essay on Hiroshima and your father and the Japanese boy that you were in correspondence with as a child, I couldn't help but think that you were sort of the moral response to the propagandist Tom Brokaw and his Greatest Generation, kind of meme. And, you know, but Brokaw would make the barons of the Soviet media empire blush, you know, in terms of the sort of just shameless America First cheerleading.
Well, we kids who grew up with those World War II vet fathers, I mean, I think it was a very common experience that they were remarkably silent. I know many other. I mean, we all grew up, we all played World War II. We had, you know, with Army surplus.
You wanted to be a diplomat growing
I did.
Up. We were talking earlier.
I was a very American kid. I mean, like my generation, even the generation that ended up going out into the streets, we went out into the streets because we thought somebody would listen to us. We were closer to the idea of American democracy, even if we were deluded about it. And I grew up, I thought the most glorious thing I could do would be to represent my country abroad. I dreamt of being a diplomat all the way into the middle of it fled in the Vietnam period. That dream fled. And I mean, one of the things for me about Tom Dispatch, I didn't know this when I began it, I didn't know it for years, but now I feel that that desire has returned to me in the form of Tom Dispatch. I feel like in some way I represent not our world, but at least myself to the world. And I do my citizenly duty. I grew up with a strong sense of citizenly duty, and Tom Dispatch for me has kind of fulfilled that sense of citizenly duty.
Thank you. And if you don't subscribe to it, you should get Tom Dispatch. It's an incredible resource read by a lot of, important people and unfamous people that are also important, important in the sense that they're probably nervous about what Tom is writing. I wanted to ask you a sort of more generic question. Yeah. Given how much thought you put into what you write, and anyone who reads Tom knows that when he publishes an article by another author, he often writes his own essay before it to give it context and put it in the broader sense. And often those essays are as equally as insightful as the authors that you publish. But I wanted to ask you, with the role that social media has played in various world events recently, with Twitter and Facebook and all these things, do you generally think it's a force for good? Because you also are an old school guy. You believe in books.
I do. I do. It's
and,
true.
And I'm curious at your response.
I have to say, I mean, it's obviously an enormously mixed bag, but I mean... I'm twice as old as almost everybody in the world I was plunged into, the internet world I was plunged into. And so I bring a lot of old-fashioned things to that world. I mean, pieces at Tom Dispatch, I'm a manic editor. I've been an editor all my life. Everything's edited. Everything's edited carefully. Everybody says that people read short. I write long, not just personally, but at Tom Dispatch. I consider it a framework and connect the dots site. My idea of myself, I mean, I don't think, when people ask me, am I a journalist? I say no. I say I'm a guy in a room, and I don't mean that modestly. I think of Jon Stewart as a guy in a room. He's just got a much better room than I do, you know? But I think we need guys in rooms who just aren't in all those trees and can actually take, you know, sit there and look. So I kind of, but I find the internet a wondrous thing in a lot. I mean, for instance, you were talking about the military. One of the amazing things to me, I have several people who write for Tom Dispatch who are retired military guys. And I mean, I get letters from, you know, general. I've gotten letters from generals, guys on bases, whatever. And they write about military things. They tend to get a lot of letters. And one of the things that you can see, it's anecdotal, but you can see that there is not a monolithic U.S. military. There are a lot of guys in the military who are disturbed by what's going on, who have a different vision of this country and what a military should actually be doing. This is not a monolithic country. And the internet, I wouldn't know that without the internet. In terms of the internet, I don't like all the yakking. There's no comments section at Tom Dispatch. I don't like that. But people write me. I try to write back when I can. People write me about their lives from all over the world, and it's the most striking experience. And since I was in the 60s and kind of the underground press in the 60s, and I know it was so much harder to get out. I mean, this is amazing. So I'm amazed by it, and I'm amazed by the way it's being used. Mm. You know, people were saying, these aren't Twitter revolutions and so on and so forth, but they kind of are.
Well, Tunisia, I think, most definitely. I mean, Egypt, though, the Mubarak regime shut down the internet.
It was going.
I mean, the reason I wanted to ask you about this is because I've been thinking about this being around a lot of young people and aspiring journalists and people with a lot of energy, that what an amazing thing it would be if we found a way to really unite people with wisdom and old-school muckraking skills with this new generation of energetic young people who are very tapped into social media. And it happens to an extent. But I think that's a dialogue that journalists and thinkers and intellectuals and artists have to have, is how do we take what was really amazing about that older generation of journalists and thinkers who really spent time getting to know an issue, and then the young people who are all about, let's get this change going right now. And it's a creative space that we need to make room for to have that kind of discussion.
Let me say just two things. One is, you know, a lot of people have said here in this country that people go on Facebook or they're on the internet and they're not out in the streets, and that one of the problems with the internet is that it takes you away from now. We've just learned that this isn't true, that this has something to do with our country. I mean, we're not out there at this point for whatever complicated reason, but it doesn't have to be. We now know that Twitter, Facebook, and all these things can put you right out on the streets. And I find that actually very exciting. I mean, that's the one thing I would say about, in addition to that. Yeah.
Let's do a couple of, we have a few minutes left. Let's do a couple rapid fire subject areas.
I'm like Tom Dispatch. It's impossible for you to answer quickly, but go ahead.
it's like they used to say about Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker, that she believed in anarchism as long as she was the anarch.
That's Tom Dispatch with the no. Is Mubarak running your comment section? No.
Oh, I know what else I was going to say, which was that, you know, when they say that an 82-year-old guy closed down the internet, if, you know, that's like saying that I closed down the internet. You know that young people are going to get around that.
Right, right.
You know, it's like the V-chip. When they invented the V-chip, I thought, what a stupid invention. Only kids will be able to handle the V-chip in the house. No parent could ever close their kid down.
But you know, but there's something very serious that came about with this 82-year-old man who shut down the internet. Joe Lieberman, an almost equally scary man as Mubarak, he actually is proposing that we have an internet off switch.
Yes.
You know, he's one of, and it's actually a very serious issue that's for another time. But let's run through a couple things here that I have learned so much from your writing and reporting on drones and drone bombing and this idea of people going to work, as you described, at Creech Air Force Base. In fact, I know someone that I communicate with on Twitter who works as one of those drone pilots at Creech Air Force Base. And I've had a dialogue with him online over the course of many months. But the Obama administration has dramatically escalated the use of these drones. So talk about that, because you've done some really groundbreaking work on air war in this modern era.
Yeah, air war is completely overlooked. I mean, reporters do not report until the drones were kind of sexy, so that they've gotten some reporting. Actual air war was not sexy, and yet the air war itself has been detached. I mean, the striking thing, we still call it air war, it's really not air war, it's actually air slaughter, because our planes cannot be hit by anything. I mean, in the wars they're fighting, some helicopters maybe, but our planes cannot go down. So they are functionally, they're like drones, but with pilots in them, basically, if you think about it realistically. And there, and air power, I mean, one of the things that always stuns me here is if some guy puts a vest on, goes into a room, blows himself up, it's barbaric, and it is barbaric. If you're up in the air, and air power, you're always going to kill people. You're not just going to get your target, no matter how precise they claim it's going to be. Some guy goes up in a plane, shoots, you know, kills a bunch of people. We don't consider it barbarism. We consider it war, and it's called collateral damage. You know?
How many wedding parties have we bombed in Afghanistan?
This drives me crazy, because on the whole, I find Americans don't care. They care if it happens in Tucson, but if it happens in Afghanistan, Americans don't care. And the least popular stuff I write is stuff about foreign casualties. I return to it always. I started counting wedding parties we had wiped out. One in Iraq, and I had counted six in Afghanistan. These are just ones where there were reports. Starting the first one in Afghanistan, December 2001, a party of 102 people reveling, 100 died. These are weddings. To me, that's front page news. You wipe out seven weddings, and that doesn't include funerals, memorial ceremonies, child naming ceremonies. I mean, all of which I have cases of this. This is what, I mean, most of those are air power. You know, this is what we do, and you are not going to fight a war like this and not have us continually do this, so that we are constantly, the American way of war that makes us safe, supposedly, I don't think it does, but supposedly makes us safe, ensures that lots of people out there, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands over the course of time in all sorts of various ways, die. And I think we don't care much about that. I don't mean everybody, but generally speaking, it's just not an issue here. Americans, and this is the drones, Americans are remarkably detached from the wars they fight, and so I think it's not surprising that we should have ended up with our ultimate, sexiest, perfect weapon, which will in the end get us nowhere, being a weapon in which you are literally detached from the weapon. And of course, the future generations of those weapons, they're already developing them. They're just going to be and worse and worse.
We're running very short on time, but Tom, you're also going to stick around and talk to people as you sign your books. But I, as a final question, I wanted to ask you to sort of play this out over the next decade and where you see with the U.S. at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, with an increasingly militarized State Department, with neoliberal economic policies in Latin America and elsewhere in the world, the austerity measures you talked about, and the growing perception that the U.S. is waging war on the world, where do you see our country and the world in 10 years?
I think my answer to that has to be that I mean, I will try and give you some kind of an answer, but my answer has to be that I'm very hesitant about predictions of the future. If we were any good at predicting the future, as human beings, we're terrible. Otherwise, I would at this moment be riding with one of those jetpacks-inspired cities as they promised me I would when I was a kid.
I ask you because you're one of your specialties. Is you've really shown a remarkable gift for reading trends.
I think the one thing that I see that's absolutely clear is we are a declinist state. That imperial America that had those 20 years where we felt we were utterly victorious, it's gone. And that's what you see in the Middle East right now. These people are left. Yes, they can fiddle behind the scenes. Yes, they train most of the Egyptian general staff, so on and so forth. But nonetheless, what they're left with, and you can see it as kind of rhetoric at this point, they're not going to be able to intervene militarily in Egypt. 20 years ago, maybe they would have acted differently. But I think there is some degree to which our decline is happening faster. Thank you, George W. Bush, and maybe those globalists. Is what's happening much faster than one might imagine. And empires, when they decline, they sometimes unravel very quickly. So while I'm not predictive, I think the answer is I don't think we're going to be, General Petraeus aside, I don't think we're going to be in Afghanistan in 2020. I don't think we'll be able to afford it.
You know? I want to just close by echoing something that Tom brought up, and that is this horrible tragedy that took place in Tucson. The media coverage has been absolutely brilliant and has been appropriate, where we know the names of the people who died, the story of the little girl and the dreams that were snatched away from her by that shooting, the bravery of the aides that surrounded Representative Gabby Gifford. Just the heroic coming together of people. And imagine a world where we had journalists that covered the victims of our wars that way, where we knew the names of those orphans in Afghanistan, where there was a commitment to showing people in this country the end result of their tax dollars going to pay for war, of their silence sometimes, of their sins of omission. We live in a different world, and a lot of it boils down to truth tellers and media. And we've been sitting in the presence of one of them today, and we thank Tom Engelhardt very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you to the Lannan Foundation. Pick up your copy of Tom Engelhardt's book, The American Way of War. Thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.